Welcome to the latest edition of the Theo Fantastique podcast. Today I'm going to be interviewing Eric Davis, author of a number of books. Today we'll be focusing on Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica. I hope you enjoy today's show.
One question that I didn't send you previously, can you share with folks some of your background and how that relates to your study of the esoteric and particularly your book Nomad Codes?
Sure. I've been a freelance writer for 20-odd years, and I started out being a cultural critic, but I was always interested in those funny places where popular culture overlapped religion and particularly spirituality or alternative spirituality, the sort of countercultural stream of magic and Buddhism and mysticism and psychedelia that really helped partly define the 1960s, 70s, and you know, into the 80s, and then it's sort of come and gone since then. And so as I wrote about music and film and books and things, I was always sort of interested in that overlap, and I just kind of made it more and more my focus, so that now I'm in a PhD program in religious studies, and I'm, you know, do my own podcast on consciousness and spirituality. So it ended up being more my core interest. But it's always been that overlap of culture, popular culture, underground culture, and religion that's really interested me.
Well, I appreciate that. I especially enjoyed your book on Burning Man Festival in the past, and I also enjoyed Nomad Codes very much. For those listeners who may not be familiar with the term, the subtitle of your book, Adventures in Modern Esoterica, what do you mean by and how are you defining the esoteric and popular culture?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's a tough one coming up with an umbrella term to talk about the things that I'm interested in. The sort of the usual one is spiritual or spirituality, and there's a lot of problems with that term. It's a rough one. And, you know, as somebody who's been writing about this stuff for so long, I've had to wrestle with that word so many times that I wanted to avoid it, even at the risk of being a little bit more unclear. But what I mean by esoterica is basically the kind of hidden side of spirituality, of consciousness, of subculture, because it really means the inner side or the hidden side of things. So religions have esoteric and then more public faces, but so does culture. When you start to search out subcultures and particularly really marginal groups, they often have a quality of esoterica. And so by saying modern esoterica, I'm trying to talk about how, you know, more traditional esoteric streams like the occult or hermeticism or alchemy or Sufism, like these kinds of esoteric traditions, how are they translating themselves into the modern world? But I also wanted to suggest that there's something about modern culture in general, contemporary culture in general, that has these esoteric potentials, even if they're just fandoms for, you know, fiction writers like H.P. Lovecraft or people who are enthusiastic about events like Burning Man that have a sort of subcultural dimension to them where they're it ends up having this kind of esoteric quality, even if it's not explicitly occult or mystical.
Well, you cover a lot of ground in the book, and some of the subject matter connects more directly to my blog, Theo Fantastique, and I'd like to explore some of that. One of the essays, I was pleased and surprised at the same time to see your discussion when you looked at Klingon fan cultures in connection with both Star Trek conventions and when these subcultures meet beyond the actual convention experience. In what ways do you see a Klingon fan culture incorporating aspects of the esoteric?
Sure, that was a wonderful piece for me. I did it it was from the early 1990s, so it was sort of the growth of the next generation period, and there was sort of a resurgent sense of Star Trek. And I just went to a con just to kind of go and check it out and see if there was a story worth telling. And I encountered these Klingons. And then when I started to hang out with them and talk to them more, I realized that partly just because I witnessed one of their rituals, that they were clearly drawing from neo-paganism in their rituals. And I was like, where does that come from? And then I started talking to them, and then it turned out that a lot of them were neo-pagans, and that while they made a distinction between their real religious neo-pagan practice in worshiping the old gods, or whether they were Celtic or a heathen, they were interested in different traditions in the neo-pagan scene, and they did draw a distinction between that and what they were doing as fans of Klingons and as people interested in dressing up and doing Klingon gatherings. There was clearly an overlap, a way that popular culture became a place for them to explore their neo-pagan imagination, and vice versa. Neo-paganism gave them a way to understand or to enjoy their, cultural identification or their consumption of television culture in a new way. And, of course, there are very deep ties between American neo-paganism, and it's true in Britain as well, not so sure about other places, but there are deep ties between American neo-paganism and science fiction fantasy culture. In a way, it makes sense. You know people who are interested in other worlds, in speculative fiction, in possibilities, whether science fictional or fantasy, and obviously fantasy has all the connections with the occult, et cetera. But even sociologically, that a lot of the forms and even kind of cultural styles that you see associated with science fiction and fantasy fandom, particularly from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, a lot of those styles and ways of socializing, forms of humor, very much play into American neo-paganism. And there's quite a lot of overlap, especially in those earlier generations, before the kind of rise of massive media fandom. And so I think it's a very key story that shows, again, how cultural objects, even television shows, can be the site for a certain kind of imaginative investment that is not so different than what we see with people who are pursuing, and especially people who are creatively exploring the possibilities of their own religious identity.
Definitely. A few moments ago, you mentioned horror writer H.P. Lovecraft, and if you study him and his writings and his background for a while, you'll come across the claim that his own claim that he was an atheist and a rationalist. But you and some others have started to connect him to esotericism. How do you make that connection?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I remain, like a lot of people, endlessly fascinated with Lovecraft. I've been reading him since I was 13 or 14, and I still go back. I still think about it. I still follow it through, and that's one of the great paradoxes, of course, is that not only did he create this very, very imaginatively powerful and fresh view of the cosmic situation, a view that combines what we would call science fiction and an older fantasy tradition or a horror tradition in a very startling way, which is part of what makes him unique, is precisely that blend. But more to the point is that even though there's all of this sort of esoteric play in his stories, there are these, unspoken tomes of magic, and there's this sense that there's some kind of reality that's peering through his pulp fictions, whether that comes from his dreams or whether it comes from his imagination or his own interest in esoteric books or in books in general. Of course, his own position was one of a staunch atheist, of a kind of pessimistic materialist who believed there was no meaning in the cosmos. There was no loving hand. There was no even sort of pattern of organic development that we could sort of rely on as a placement for God. Instead, we were alone in a meaningless universe chained to these dying animal bodies. And so that tension is really fascinating. And so when you discover that, once again, there have been, real occultists, actual magical practitioners, even some Satanists, who have been interested in Lovecraft, not just as a fiction writer, but as a source or an inspiration for their own occult imaginings, it makes you go, well, how does that work? You know, and part of my essay is about saying, well, how can that be? How can somebody who has, you know, a rational point of view come up with imaginative fictions that feed something deeper in people, in readers, and even more, I would say even more, that actually create a sense of some kind of alien presence that has a cosmic magical or occult kind of quality. And there, I explore two main, you know, theses. One of them is dreams, is that he had a remarkable dream life. And while dreams are not the same thing as the gods, it's certainly the case that for a lot of us, the more enchanted aspects of our imaginations, the realms where we can see gods or where animals speak or where we, you know, have bizarre and wonderful things happen is in our dream lives. And, of course, Lovecraft ported in his dreams and especially his nightmares into many of his fictions. So there's a sense that there's something coming through his mind as well, whether it's his subconscious or the archetypal subconscious or some other realm, as some occultists believe or at least suggest, or coming through his own dream life into his text, which then become the source of our own dreams, our own collective dreams in fiction, in fantasy, in comic books, in gaming. And as we go into those fictions, those dreams become alive again. And it's really the second part that has, I think, the more important part of the story is really just about books and media, that there are certain ways that authors, whether they're religious authors or whether they're fictional authors, can set in motion a kind of network of effects between different fictions that create this ominous sense that there's some real world outside of the fiction. And Lovecraft did that very well by having different creatures refer to each other across different pulps, and the way that he wrote his stories so that they had a kind of documentary texture, a sense of journalism, a sense of books talking to other books. Some of the books are real, some of the books are fake. He was very good at playing with a kind of magical realism, except this is magic with a K. You know, he's taking the way that texts can talk to other texts and using it as a way to create a larger space of possibility, a space that many occultists have just sort of like walked right in and decided to, you know, set up shop.
Fascinating stuff. I hope other folks continue to probe that and see whether there might be more to it than what little I've seen on it so far.
Yeah.
One aspect of the discussion of modern esoterica, we couldn't cover all the bases if we didn't, in some sense, talk about James Cameron's film Avatar. In some of the discussion I've seen where there's recognition of what some would call New Age elements in it, it's usually dismissed as being superficial and it's ridiculed at times. But from your essay in your book, Nomad Codes, you take it far more seriously. Can you comment on some of the psychedelic aspects of the film and ways in which esoterica may combine with spiritual expressions in the film that shows that this is a significant part of what Cameron was presenting cinematically?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. I mean, anyone who is sort of familiar with particularly the rise of interest in ayahuasca and shamanism over the last 10, 15 years will recognize a number of motifs that are similar in ayahuasca culture. And by saying that, I mean more people from the West, from North America and Europe who become interested in the shamanic practitioners of South America. Maybe they fly down there, maybe they get an Indian shaman, maybe it's a mestizo group of, or like Santo Daime, which is a mixture of Christianity and more native traditions, or they're experiencing it underground up in North America with hippie leaders or shamans who are visiting, and there's a sort of neo-shamanic worldview that has really become quite significant, at least in those sort of new age, hippie, neo-tribal circuits. And again, anybody familiar with that scene would see clear connections between the mythology of the Na'vi and how they function in the movie, and particularly the kind of world tree, and that the role that played in plugging them into a networked mind. The idea that the individual can use some device, in this case, literally these, you know, their ponytails, can use some device to plug into a matrix of information that is associated with the planet, with organic life, with a kind of Gaian spirit. That's a very psychedelic motif, because, I mean, it's New Age in just sort of a general sense, but it's particularly psychedelic in that there's a kind of practice associated with it that transforms people's minds. So I wrote about that, and I got picked up, and people had various responses, and a lot of people real snuffy about it, like, oh, no, it doesn't matter. He wasn't influenced by psychedelics. He was a deep sea diver, and that's what motivated him, and things like that. And then when the DVD came out, it turned out there were some cut scenes, and in one of them it shows I can't quite remember exactly the details, but they basically have two elements that they have to combine in order to sort of, you know, launch their trip, their experience, which is a very explicit reference to ayahuasca, in the sense that the effects of ayahuasca are derived from the combination of two different plants. Without both of those plants being there, it's ineffective. So it was a very clear nod to people who are interested in that kind of interpretation. We'll never know the case. We'll never know whether Cameron is interested in that, or whether, you know, some of his animators are, or whatever. But it's the same kind of world that overlaps, you know, the New Age and mystical thinking and psychedelic culture and the sort of Gaian mind. Like, all of those are very deep cultural threads in California, in Hollywood, in the same sorts of milieu that you would find computer programmers and CG guys and you know, even famous Hollywood directors. So I think it's not an unreasonable argument about their motivations in particular, but more deeply is the point that there's a way in which we try to dream in our technology and in our cultural artifacts to sort of either supplant or satisfy desires that tie into deeper sources. So a lot of human beings in our culture, especially today, feel very rootless. There's this, you know, ambient sense of dread around what's happening to the planet, a sense that human civilization is spun way out of control, with population and extractive resources and the collapse of ecosystems and the loss of biodiversity. And, you know, you and me and everybody else listening or reading this knows what I'm talking about. And one thing that those desires and those anxieties lead to is a desire to plug in more deeply with the planet, with the idea that there's some way in which we can be more balanced, or at least connect more deeply with the larger ecology of which we're a part. Now, is it helpful or not that you have those needs satisfied or played with imaginatively in this huge Hollywood spectacle where the computer graphics and the 3D technology, in a sense, become the drug that allow us as viewers to have this experience, to move into another world, a world that's not just a fantasy science fiction, but a world within which it is possible to plug into this organic matrix of consciousness. And, you know, overall, I think that's a good thing. I think it's great that especially, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-olds saw that movie, and it probably blew their minds. And some of them might turn to ecology. Some of them might become interested in shamanism or Native Americans or ways of living on the planet that might provide us with inspirations or even just handy rules of thumb as we are forced to renegotiate our relationship with the planet, which is definitely one of the major themes of our time.
Your book also touches on the paranormal. And I was pleased to see your essay that touched on UFOs and alien visitations, what surprised me in that piece was the mention of a major figure in Silicon Valley, Joe Fermage, and his great passion for that particular topic that actually led to the detriment of his career. Can you sketch a little bit for us, how did this come about? How did one of the major figures in Silicon Valley develop this great passion, and how was it received by his fellows that he was in business with?
Yeah, again, a fascinating story of one of these overlaps. Of course, everywhere you go in society, you're going to find people who have had, who've seen UFOs or have had encounters, who have had dreams, who have had things that are more than dreams or seem to be more than dreams. You'll find them at all levels of society, in the military, in the government, in corporations, et cetera, et cetera. So in some sense, he's just another one of these guys, except that he was particularly articulate. He had a lot of money. He had a lot of confidence in himself, and he had a kind of, how to say, a spirit that was both religious and scientific. He had been raised a Mormon, but had turned away from his childhood faith and had embraced science, but he had embraced it with a certain kind of zealotry and also a certain kind of draw to the cosmic. So when he had this sort of extraordinary encounter, you know, one of these stories that you hear about with thousands of people who have had encounters with strange beings, maybe they're aliens, maybe they're elves, maybe they're, you know, interdimensional wanderers. But he had one of these extraordinary experiences, a sense of downloading cosmic information. But rather than just kind of going, wow, I better keep that to myself, or privately pursuing his own spiritual interests while he continues to be a captain of digital industry, he instead decided, as is often the case with people who become interested in UFOs, that we're almost at the point of transformation. This sense that there's something just ahead that's going to rewrite history. And one of those ideas is that there's tons of people in the government who know about this, and the information is almost out there, so it's going to flip. And suddenly the government and the military, everybody announces that we know that there's been UFOs around for decades, and they've been hiding it, but now it's time to pass into this new world of UFO information. And the other idea is that we're on the lip of discovering remarkable sources of energy, that we're almost at a point where we're going to, you know, be able to tap the quantum vacuum and essentially have free energy, which, of course, would utterly transform life on this planet and tie us more deeply into the life of the cosmos. And so these ideas drove him so strongly that he put himself out there. He decided to go public, to write a huge book, to be part of that transformative process by throwing himself out there, by putting the ideas and the images out there. And, of course, once he did that, his competitors saw his Achilles heel was suddenly very exposed, and they went after him, and mockery and the usual snideness that accompanies these issues for those of us who are interested in these things. We all know what it's like to bring them up to people who don't have that interest or don't actually know very much about it. And there's a whole world of snideness and mockery and ignorance around a lot of these squirrely topics. And he got it in spades, and he was essentially forced out of his company. And when I spoke to him, I mean, he was at a point in his life where, he couldn't really tell. Did I just make a big mistake? Was this worth it? Did I need to do this? You know, was it an ethical gesture, or was I foolish? And it was a very interesting thing to see somebody really kind of stand up for their feelings and not just do what most people working in business do, which is just to kind of like keep doing it and sort of ignore the ethical problems and the deeper call of your soul and what you really want to do. And so I have great admiration for that character. He was a very, very smart, very, very articulate guy. And he went on to do some interesting things, but he's definitely had to change his life plan.
Sounds like it, definitely. One final question for you, Eric. Religion scholars like my friend and colleague J. Gordon Melton, well known for his work in new religious movements, are urging fellow scholars to take Western esotericism more seriously as a major influence in American religiosity. And my question to you is, do you think its place and influence in popular culture and the kinds of things you explore in your book, Nomad Codes, is that another reason why it should be taken seriously?
Oh, definitely. In a way, I'm just one part of a groundswell that's occurred over the last 10 years, 15 years, around esotericism, not just in America, but in Western tradition in general, because, of course, when you open it up to the history of Europe, it's even more the case that esoteric interests and practices and groups and ideas are at the core of philosophy, politics, art, architecture, you know, all sorts of things are deeply, deeply influenced by this esoteric tradition that, in terms of scholarship and sort of mainstream academic recognition, has really only started to be really paid attention to in the last 15, 20 years. There have been individuals and schools that have paid attention to this stuff before, but there really is a groundswell now. There's conferences and there's books and there's journals, and I'm, you know, as a PhD candidate, I'm kind of part of that stream. So in some ways, what I'm interested in is the way in which those currents, which whether they're official organized currents where people are in secret societies or they're practicing in particular hermetic or esoteric influenced occult traditions, or whether they're just sort of participating in a more ambient, informal strand of that material as part of their, you know, postmodern attempt to bring meaning into their lives, the reality of those currents is you know, not in doubt. And I guess part of my work has really been to emphasize the informal side of that, the way that outside of specific sectarian groups or particular well-defined religious traditions or esoteric traditions, that you still see an enormous amount of this influence of these signs, you know, throughout the subcultural and cultural field. So yeah, I feel like I'm very much part of that operation, albeit in a way that's very specifically rooted in popular culture and in the experience of the counterculture.
Well, Eric, I thank you for helping me secure a copy of your great book, and I hope it does well in sales and getting out there. And I am also appreciative of your taking time for this discussion, this podcast, and I'm envious of your PhD program. I wish you well in that.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful chat.